And so, without that context, it's just that, it's a story.
First of all, a multiple of EBITDA is not a valuation. We often joke around that it's called buyer fever, as I call it. Hello, and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Racket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. If you tune in regularly, you know that Revenue Racket is the world's premier advisor, M&A advisor to IT services companies. With me today are my partners, Ryan Barnett and Matt Lockhart. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here, Mike, as always. Happy spring, guys. It's days are getting longer, and we're in full swing. What's going on, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. We just wrapped up our sellers really focused masterclass. So if you're thinking about selling your company in a year or two, I think it's a great masterclass. I think we might revisit a few topics within that, but thanks for everyone for going through it. Today, I just wanted to take a little step back and have a little more fun on a podcast based on a lot of the things that we see in our world that end up being myths about mergers and acquisition for the IT services world. So oftentimes we hear something from a friend, a buddy, a coworker, classmate about deals in all sorts of ways. And oftentimes these statements of fact are very far from the actual. So today, just let's talk about myths in M&A that just need to die. Oh, Mike, I'd love for you to get us going. We do hear a lot of things from founders about what their business is worth, how deals work, where people see, where are people really oversimplifying things the most right now? And why don't you get us going?
Will do, Ryan. So really, I would tell you it's not where people are, it's not that people are necessarily wrong with some of the myths that they believe or assumptions. It's just that they're missing context. And with that, Ryan, what myth should we start with?
Absolutely. So, one of the things we hear a lot, and I think this is probably the most common myth we hear all the time. Matt, maybe take the first one here is my friend's company sold for 12x EBITDA. My friend's company sold for 4x revenue. Or my buddy got XYZ. And I'd love for, why is that a myth in the first place? And what are a few things that as a CEO listening to this might be takeaway from those comparisons?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things, right? Every circumstance is its own circumstance, right? And so when we all have heard those stories, right? And honestly, probably most of them are true stories, but they're kind of just that. They're stories because they're missing the context, right? They're missing the context of what are the like-to-like capabilities? What are the sizes of the business? What is the general scope of the contracts? What's the maturity timing, right, that the business has been around? And then the associated leadership maturity. I mean, all of the context of all of these things, growth rate. I mean, boy, we talked about that in our sell side series, the importance of that. And so, without that context, it's just that, it's a story.
I think this is the one we hear we hear it all the time. And Mike, when someone hears a price or something else, and maybe they even go to a step of saying, let's go to market with this idea, how do you end up resetting expectation without losing them?
Well, I think you gotta, translate gently, right? You gotta be asking the question, well, compared to what? And really ultimately think about, having them trust you as an advisor, right? Your advisors are experienced, whether it's us or another advisor in the space. You'd hope that they're experienced enough to anchor deals with facts and not conjecture. You know, when you hear about your buddy's deal sold for X, you know, EBITDA, as an example, first of all, the multiple of EBITDA is not a valuation, and there's so many components to that. So I think you got to be able to begin to understand that with each situation being different, you really need to anchor in facts. And, you know, there's many, many examples where I've heard with people call us and say, hey, you know, they say, hey, I've heard this or I've heard that. And it's just not factual. And so, you know, we can take a look at your financials and give you, you know, the benefit of our experience on where a deal like yours would trade. You're going to want to do that ahead of time, right? As well by doing a real valuation, by understanding the context for which an ideal buyer would pay that. And I think if you can get there, then you're in a place where, you know, you can, you know, better take that advice and not have it be a myth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think having that base case and understanding where the reality is your market, working with an advisor for proper valuation is really going to help get that done. You are unique, and sometimes that your uniqueness is going to really bring a valuation that is different for you. And I think that's good to hear. You know, I'm moving on to another myth, and Matt, or pardon me, Mike, I'll throw this one your way. We oftentimes hear, and this can be one way or another, hey, PE companies are going to pay more, or strategics are going to pay more. And we have this kind of PE versus strategic debate. And I'd love to understand, you know, what actually determines who's going to pay more, and why doesn't that headline kind of enterprise value number always wins when it comes to separating out the strategic versus private equity debate?
Yeah, I would tell you that there is neither one or the other will typically pay more. There's myths around who will pay more. Certainly there's a belief that strategic will pay more than PE. I don't believe that to be true, because there's plenty of sponsored strategics. And so what category do you put those guys in, right? Now the lines get blurry. Are they a strategic, or are they PE, or are they both? Or, you know, there's a lot of things that determine paying more, which is, how do you define paying more? You know, cash at close versus structure. How do you weigh certainty to close? You know, all those things occur. And I think, you know, the one way to think about it is there's got to be a reasonable path to return on behalf of the buyer. And they have to understand what that internal rate of return is and what their own threshold is and what their comfort is in order to really do a deal. And that is not different between PE or strategics. Not like strategics don't think that way. All the strategics we work with, and believe me, we work with lots of them on the buy side, have that discipline, that same discipline that PE would have. And if they don't, when they come to us to help them buy a company, we help them get that discipline. Because you have to understand, in very simple terms, how you're going to get a return rate on your investment through this acquisition. Where are there synergies? How you're going to capitalize on those synergies? That's not different between a private equity firm, a strategic buyer, or a private equity sponsored strategic. Those are all certainly real. And we've seen both flavors of companies pay above market based on our perspective. A lot of it depends on, do you run a sell side process? Is there competition? How do you manage that competition? What is structure and what's guaranteed? All those things play into, you know, and there's a certain point in time too, where the desire of the buyer to be in your market or have your company, we often joke around, that's called buyer fever, as I call it, will impact price and terms. And that can happen with a PE or a strategic. The key is how many buyers can you get in there with buyer fever to be, and what I translate that into is their desire to transact your deal becomes so strong that they're willing to pay up. And that has to be through an orchestrated process. It's probably the best way to get it. You're not going to get it if somebody just calls you on the blue, I think, in general. I think you have to think about, you know, what is the best for you. And ultimately, there is no right or wrong answer on, I think, who's going to pay more, PE or strategics.
And I think one thing to note here, and we've said this before, but private equity is a bit smarter than it used to be. Even these monikers or definitions of PE radically changed. And you get some really smart money these days that strategic company backed by PE. And so this debate of the strategic versus PE, I think, is something that requires a bit more nuanced to really come through. And it's a bit of a myth to have it out there now.
Yeah, I think that's great, Ryan. And if you don't think about the strategic, what will this acquisition do for me? And the return as a seller, regardless of whether the opportunity is with a pure strategic buyer, a PE buyer, or a PE-backed strategic, you're going to be losing, you're going to be leaving money on the table because you're not conveying, you know, the nuance to your point, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Matt, if I just another myth that we hear again, so setting the table for a new one. We hear a lot that earnouts are bad, or hey, I just don't want an earnout as part of my deal. And I'd love to hear your take on this. Why is this? Why do we think this is a myth, and why should it be busted?
Yeah, you know, it comes from, I think, again, those stories, you know, and in all of life, right? You know, those bad stories, those proverbial train wrecks are the ones that get the most attention. And there have been bad out earnout scenarios out there. But it's really not a reality when you are working with professionals that understand the process of mergers and acquisitions. That's your lawyer, but obviously your advisor as well. And the reality is that when earnouts are aligned correctly to the interests of both parties, and then structured correctly as well to incent both parties to go get it, then earnouts can be a great thing. You know, there is the obvious and natural, it's the balance of risk. In some scenarios, there's been, you know, just extreme growth within a business. And you're going to get credit for that growth, but you're saying, look, I can keep up this rate of way more than market average growth within a business. And the buyer says, well, that's awesome. Then we all win. But, you know, that's tough, right? You know, but so let's structure an opportunity for you to earn even more money, right? Because you are working at an accelerated pace, right? And you have the opportunity to go get that. In other scenarios, you know, the measures are different. And so it really is an opportunity to win together. You know, Mike, I think you coined the, you know, think of an earnout as a gain share. Everybody is gonna win together and then share amongst that. And so again, there have been bad ones out there. That's where the myth comes from. But you know, well-designed, well thought out earnouts can be a very good tool in the overall structure of an agreement.
I think you nailed it. Yeah, that's great. I looked to one more myth coming on here. It's a bit of market timing. And Mike, sometimes sellers, when they look at selling their company, they want to try to really time the peak and get to the best deal at the exact right time. How do buyers actually look at performance over time compared to just trying to time the market? And help me understand, you know, this myth of timing the market and selling when it's at the peak.
Yeah, sure thing. You know, timing the market, just like timing the stock market, is pretty hard to do. And certainly evidenced by recent swings on the VIX on the stock market. Whoa, we tried to time the market to buy or sell stocks in the last several months, you'd be challenged to hit the timing right. I think that it's a little different sort of driver when you're looking to sell your company, because you know, buyers normalize the peaks and valleys in your business. They don't simply value the business on a trailing 12 months EBITDA. So a lot of people believe they can just go crush it in any given year and then command a premium, even though there may have been a lot of volatility to the revenue and profit in past years. And they don't believe that a buyer will build in a more meaningful look back period in their valuation. And that's just plain not true. I would say that, you know, look back periods go anywhere from 3 to 5 years in your business when someone's doing a credible valuation. Now, certainly forecast and up and to the right in a sort of graph is important, right? How you grow, how you're growing, what the market opportunity is in front of you. But your history is frankly more important. And so when you think about how someone values your business, if they're doing a credible job, you know, there's this historical valuation component, weighted averages on out years, and or averages on out years, usually weighted average for revenue and profit contribution. And then there's, you know, discounted cash flow in your forecast. You have to have a believable forecast. And then there's comps where other deals come into play like yours. And smart buyers are going to analyze all those things in doing their valuation. And that means that any given outlier year probably doesn't have as big a positive or negative impact. Obviously, if you're looking to sell, you'd hope to be a positive upswing impact than you might think. Because a businesses, for transaction purposes, are not simply valued on a trailing 12-month EBITDA. That's a proxy for what you might be worth. That's easy to calculate, but it's not a valuation. And I would encourage you to go get credible advice about what you're really worth if you're contemplating exiting, and know that it's not just a multiple.
Yeah, and the other thing here is, and Mike, maybe you could expand on this a little bit too, is just the timing of the macroeconomic market. Do you think firms get pulled into kind of timing, as you mentioned earlier, just like timing the stock market? How much impact does the macroeconomic environment play into this when you're starting to consider selling your firm?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, Ryan, because macroeconomics do play into to when you should think about selling. The thing that's tough about it is to analyze it in the context of the macro and micro and your definitions of both, right? I think in our market, in IT services, certainly there's a lot of drivers that come to play based on the macro market. And I'll give you an example. A lot of firms saw headwinds last year in the macroeconomic market. It caused deals to come undone. Many sellers had clients that were either putting work on hold or were rolled off because of headwinds they saw in their business. Could have been tariff related, could have been, you know, a variety of reasons caused that to occur. Now, interestingly enough, this year, a lot of that work is back. Most of the clients that have saw those headwinds last year are seeing increased demand and decisions being made. I think partially because of pent-up demand in that customer base. They couldn't wait any longer. They had to get to market with their solution or work on their initiative or their project or get started. And it does help, you know, a declining interest rate environment does help, et cetera. Now, you could argue, well, we have the, you know, we're still, as we're recording this, still in the throes of, you know, the war in the Gulf, and how might that impact it? I think in some ways you can drive yourself nuts trying to figure this out. What's much more important, I think, is the story of, you know, sustainability, consistency through these different macro periods. And as a result, you know, you will find that if we look back even 20 years, there have certainly been some years that are more and some years that are less in overall M&A volume in IT services, but there's not market differences pursuant, in my opinion, to the macro. There's subtle blips, but if you were to look at total volumes, the overall trend has continued to be up and to the right or more volume. There's some years that are less, some years that are more, just due to specific large deals generally. But in general, there's been more demand over time and higher multiples over time. And that would pretend to mean that the macro probably didn't have a super big impact on the M&A market at any particular time. We even saw that last year as I'm talking about macro and customer headwinds. Certainly deals came apart, but if you look at overall volumes last year, they were actually up over the year before. So, you know, did it make sense in the micro in a particular deal? Yeah, could have. Certainly probably did. But overall volumes, if we look at deal volumes, still were up year over year.
Yeah, so it sounds like the market performance is perhaps less important than what you want to do with your life at that time, or the state of the business when it is healthy. The kind of the other impacts that are perhaps more important than something that we have, I think, a lot less control over as well.
Yeah, I think what's much more important, if I can just weigh in on that one more comment, is that you know, the net of it is there will always be a great buyer for your business if it's been well run, right? And you're in alignment with knowing what you want out of that transaction. You've been advised well about value and options, and you know what's next for you. There'll always be a buyer. The question is, you got to find the best buyer, right? The one that aligns strategically, culturally, and financially. And that takes some work, and that takes a village, and, you know, all really important things. That's much more critical in the success of your exit or your recap than trying to market time.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Matt, if I turn the gear one more time here, a lot of things that we hear about is about the size of a firm and should you go to market. And so the myth we hear is, hey, I'm too small to sell. And there's definitely some truth with to that. There's scale is oftentimes really critical to this. But if some firms are trying to be $100 million to sell, maybe a $50 million in revenue to sell, that might be a longer term goal that's harder to hit. So, Matt, you know, What does that myth look like? Why does that I'm too small to sell?
Yeah, you know, take the number piece out of the equation, because you already addressed that, right? So, you know, knowing your number or your desired number or your range, if you will, because as we talked about, structure matters and range, and whether it's one bite at the apple or two bites at the apple. But take all that out and just say, hey, no. For whatever reason, maybe there's an opportunity to go spend time in another business that you're more interested in. Maybe it, you know, there's life scenarios that, you know, are outside of your control, where it's just the right thing to do. To Mike's point, a well-run business, there's always going to be an opportunity. There's always a market for a good business. Now, the market may be different if you're smaller than what you would have thought. But it all sort of goes back to the principles that, well, we talked about in our sell side series, Ryan, that, you know, when well prepared and working with professionals, there will always be a buyer for the business. And so that, you know, I'm too small to even consider it, right? Again, if the reason for that isn't numbers related, simply is a myth.
Yeah, well said. And then, all of these we heard today was a bit of anecdotal advice, and we do hear this all the time. Everything from my friend got way more of their business than I can, or who's going to pay more between strategics and or financial buyer, or earnouts are bad. You know, a lot of these are phrases that we hear, and they come up in very similar ways. And so I'm glad to thank you, Mike and Matt, for addressing both of these, or all of these myths. And again, if you hear something that is sounds a little bit more like a canned line and very kind of straight, you think it might be true, now take a step back and listen, and perhaps take a little bit of pause on that statement and understand kind of the reality behind it. Now, again, thank you both Mike and Matt for helping out here today. I'll leave it to Matt. Any closing thoughts? And if not, turn it over to Mike.
No, it's great. You know, talk to lots of people. Build an early relationship with an advisor and build a bridge, and they're going to help. I think Mike stated that just about perfectly. So good stuff, Ryan. Love the subject. Mike?
Yeah, I'll add just a couple things. One would be, you know, I put a plug in for getting a business valuation once a year and keeping it current. It helps to know what your asset is actually worth in the current market instead of speculating. Then it can help you inform decisions should opportunities present themselves. And likewise, be thinking more about, you know, when is the right time for you, more than trying to time the market. Certainly, when has a lot of context around it. And so, you know, when you do think about when that exit is, be thinking about the future and what that means for you. And, you know, get started sooner than later. I think running the business in the top quartile of your peers from a revenue growth and profit perspective should always be your goal. And that will give you lots of choices in the future as you contemplate an exit. So with that, we'll tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. I encourage you to tune in next time for more data about the market, the M&A market, and the IT services market at large. And with that, make it a great week.